I always had something inside of me that wanted to be independent, but I always had a sort of fire that was burning, leading me to think I should be able, I want to do this in a different way. And that was a big, big turning point, because it was like, right, I need to make this work right now. Those early days, it was a risk. I put my hand in my pocket to fund those things with no guarantees that I wasn't going to end up. Yeah, those people are expensive, even back then, like 15 years ago. I think there are moments where you just have to think, you know what, it's got to be done. Like, this work is important. Like, I really want to bring Vern Gambetta over. Overcome the risk with, do you know what, it needs to happen. I believe in it, but hopefully 40 other people believe in it, because they bloody need to. He emailed me and he said, look, I'm in Twickenham, I'm in London, I can never get to your sessions, why don't you film them? Literally that one event that we filmed turned my business from what I would have termed at the time an events business to an online content, online video business overnight.
Hello everybody, welcome to the Boxing Science Podcast. This is episode 25, an interview with Brendan Chaplin. Before we get into this week's episode, just want to give a big shout out to Saga Fitness for sponsoring this podcast. Saga Fitness are specialists in blood flow restriction training. Their smart, wearable technology are the safest and most effective way to perform blood flow restriction training. Their BFR cuffs, we use them at the Boxing Science Performance Center to help athletes get stronger in a shorter amount of time and also be able to adapt around injuries. If you're wanting to find out more about blood flow restriction training and the Saga Fitness BFR cuffs, please visit the link in the description. You can also use the Boxing Science discount code to save yourself 10% discount. Just type in Boxing Science and you can save 10% on the upper and lower limb cuffs. And you can also save on the upper and lower limb package as well. So on to this week's episode with Brendan Chaplin. For those who don't know who Brendan Chaplin is, he's a successful strength and conditioning coach that's actually become an entrepreneur with his business, Strength and Conditioning Education. I've been following Brendan for a long time and been really inspired by his work. He's been running Strength and Conditioning Education for 10 to 15 years now, and it started off with physical workshops, bringing in some of the biggest names in strength and conditioning, such as Dan Baker, Dan John, Vern Gambetta, Duncan French. And basically what he did was very, very simple in today's world, is in film it and put it online and be able to put a price on it. But he was one of the first coaches to do this in the UK. And then he's built this up into a very, very successful business with strength and conditioning education. A lot of the listeners and viewers will be accustomed with strength and conditioning education, as they do a successful level 4 strength and conditioning qualification and also the Brendan Chaplin mentorship service. So I wanted to get into like a good conversation about how he built this business, how he transitioned from an S&C coach into a successful businessman. And yeah, just it's, I think, some great nuggets of information, because a lot of people in the S&C industry and fitness industry at the moment are working as freelancers. So we're wanting to basically enhance our business to be able to reach more clients, reach more athletes, and also to bring ourselves in an income as well. So it's great to have Brendan on the podcast, and we're going to be talking about a range of different subjects. So without further ado, let's get on with episode 25 of the Boxing Science Podcast interview with Brendan Chaplin.
Okay, Brendan, thanks for coming.
Hi Dan, yeah, thanks for having me.
Good. Can you just start off with those that don't know about your background and everything, what your current role is?
Well, that's a tough question to answer, my current role. I wear a few different hats. Obviously, my company, Strength and Conditioning Education, I am the chairman of Strength and Conditioning Education now. So I have a number of different projects going on. I have a company called Impact Learning Group, that we're basically trying to acquire education companies and interesting projects that give value. And I'm sort of running that, doing some content for SCE, a little bit of S&C coaching still, but yeah, that's it really.
I'm really excited to get in a conversation with you about how you built strength and conditioning education. I think that what you've done over the last 10 years is brilliant. Paving the ways for not only more coaches to develop the strength and conditioning skills and knowledge, but also for strength and conditioning coaches to look at all that online business. I know from my point of view, like when I was starting Boxing Science, or looking at what you were doing from like kind of general strength and conditioning point of view, and thinking how can I replicate that in the boxing world. So I'm excited to learn myself, and also like I'm sure a lot of listeners will be interested in some knowledge.
No, appreciate it. Yeah, appreciate the feedback.
So let's start from like the very beginning. So you started in strength and conditioning, not start with the university, but what got you into like kind of sports, what got you into the training, and kind of take us through from that point through university and through to you being a strength and conditioning coach.
Yeah, so I really got into weightlifting when I was a teenager, purely just to look good and to sort of get confident, really. Yeah. And I realized there's quite a lot of depth to it, not just turning up to the gym and lifting weights, but actually there's a science, there's an art, there's a process to it. And it really suited me. It really suited my mentality at the time. But I was also a martial artist, so I was doing loads and loads of mixed martial arts, jiu-jitsu, and so on and so forth. And I'd never really heard of S&C. I'd been to the gym, but then my coach at the time, a guy called Carl Tanswell, who is sadly not with us anymore, but brilliant, brilliant coach, brilliant mind. He was the head of the Straight Blast gym, where Conor McGregor's from, and so on and so forth in the UK. And Carl lent me some DVDs. Remember those things that you actually put in a player? And he said, you might like this. You might get some value out of this. And I watched it and I was totally mind blown by the content. And it was strength and conditioning content, but it was foam rolling.
Okay.
And at the time I'm like, what on earth is this? And it was the sort of depth and the layers of not just jumping on a foam roller, but the why behind it. Mm. And I watched it and it was Mike Boyle's Functional Strength Coach collection.
The OG.
The OG. And it blew my mind, Danny. Like, I was like, wow, there's so much to this. And pretty much overnight, but certainly in a matter of months, it was like, right, that is going to be my path now.
Yeah.
And then I went to train with Mike in the States.
All right. What age were you about?
Early, maybe 21.
Yeah.
Something like that. Still at uni, I think, or just finishing uni. And came back. And I didn't have an undergrad degree in, say, sports science.
Right, okay.
So I was like, how am I going to make this work? And I'd seen Mike Boyle's gym and the kind of athlete development process, but also the business side. And I struck a deal with Leeds City Council out of the South Leeds Stadium to run my first business called Dynamic Athletics. And that was an S&C gym. I bought all my squat racks, wanted to train all the athletes and sports teams, and it totally bombed.
Oh, right.
And I did it. What, in hindsight, I look back at it, I just didn't know how to market myself or how to attract people to me in that time. So put a pin in that for a second. I wanted to get more knowledge and ended up doing the master's in strength and conditioning at Bolton.
Okay. What do you do your undergraduate in?
Believe it or not, it was construction management.
Okay, yeah. It's totally
so if you need
different
tips on the building here as well. But no, totally different. Having said that, the project management within that is basically advanced periodization.
Yeah, yeah.
And believe it or not, I got a lot more out of that than I realized at the time. I was like, what is this stuff? But it worked really well when it came to building programs and systems for athletes.
Yeah.
I talked my way on to the masters at Bolton. I had to do a couple of trial projects to get let into that. Really struggled to hit the level of the masters, but got through the masters in 2 or 3 years, did it part-time. And at that point, I'd applied and got a job with the English Institute of Sport out of Gateshead in the Northeast and Durham University. Mm-hmm. And Jared Deakin interviewed me.
Yeah.
And I was really surprised to get the job, but I think because I had a good ability to coach people, I'd actually been coaching for years as a martial artist and a martial arts coach. I knew what I was doing. I could communicate my message and maybe other people couldn't. So there's probably a little bit of a learning for me back then that, you know, it's not about the sets and reps as much as it is about your ability to translate that. And so from there, I went from this is pre-Beijing Olympics. I went from the EIS and then Durham University with GB rowing and some of the swimmers and other athletes pre-Beijing. I went to British Tennis and I was the lead for the North and the Midlands in the S&C Arena for British Tennis. I went to Huddersfield Giants, Leeds Met, Leeds Carnegie. I think I did 5 or 6 years as the head of S&C at Leeds Carnegie. But all that time, I was also running my own business and the early stages of strength and conditioning education as it was then. So yeah, it's been quite a journey.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah.
So you've gone from probably like strength and conditioning, first getting into it about 2006, 2007 or something like that.
Yeah,
so that's like 15, 16 years.
Yeah.
What has been the biggest change in the industry, do you think, in the past?
That's a good question.
Yeah. We've got an hour for the podcast.
So. Yeah, no, there's been a lot.
Yeah.
So I think the way to reach your athletes and ultimately it's coincided with the growth of social media. Communication is still central, but the methodologies of communication have completely changed. And I think there was Facebook back then. Trying to think back to kind of 2005, 2006.
Yeah.
But that was it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And now you've got all the other areas and so on and so forth. I still think, aside from all the tactics and the different types of training that have come out and so on and so forth, what is central that is probably more important now than ever before, because with all the noise of daily life and so on, the ability to communicate and get your message across and ultimately influence somebody's behavior is a lost art.
Yeah.
And it gets lost in the melee of, you know, all the different notifications on your phone, all the different distraction things that we suffer from, frankly. So good coaches are still the ones that are able to communicate effectively and really create like a meaningful shift and meaningful transformation in somebody's mindset as well as their physiology. And I think that's still when I see world-class and great, great coaches, they do that really, really well.
Yeah,
that's my thoughts.
Yeah, so like the values are the same, but the way that gets across,
that's it. Yeah,
has evolved in different ways.
Yeah,
when you're saying about like kind of Facebook and stuff, like just starting out when you were starting coaching, I think like it has opened the doors to being able to work with so many different people, different types of people as well.
Yeah,
like some of the people I work with one to one are like based in Australia and America. Yeah. Imagine like trying to do that 15 years ago.
But you can do it. It works, and you can deliver a great service to someone in Australia now, which is awesome, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So a lot of this podcast is going to be around kind of you growing strength and conditioning education. A lot of business talk, because I think that's what a lot of people want to hear from you as well. But before we start, we need to have a little bit of combat sport chat. So
you're
saying about MMA, did you compete at all? Or did you
grappling tournaments and some boxing stuff. I never competed pro as an MMA fighter. But do you know what? I knew it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
Because back to the DVDs and what I really like, I always loved the process of why something works and why somebody should do it. It wasn't really about the outcome for me. And so having the fortune to work with so many great MMA fighters and just people of different sports backgrounds, you see that reinforced all the time of like, that's brilliant how people manage that, but that's not for me.
Yeah.
I was an average competitor. I was competitive, but I knew my place, if you get my drift, and now I admire those guys more than ever.
Do you still keep up to date? Do you keep watching MMA?
Yeah, I love it.
What are your favourite fighters at the?
I mean, the UFC this weekend just gone was awesome. I mean, Charles Oliveira just is completely reinvented, isn't he? That was an unbelievable finish. Having been dropped a couple of times, I was at the Fury fight a couple of weeks ago.
Dillian White fight,
which was amazing atmosphere as well. Good to see Fury.
How far back were you? Were you close?
I could still see. I was just about there. I mean, I was sort of a combination of the TV screen and the actual.
Yeah.
But you know what? It was weird because, like, as you well know, you go to a lot of these events, when you see them from a distance and you're kind of going, flicking from the TV screen to the to the ring or the cage. And I actually saw the punch that Fury landed, the final uppercut. I clocked it absolutely, and I saw that Dillian White's body fall and hit the canvas. And I said to the buddy that I was with, I was like, absolutely got that. That was meant to be. That has finished the fight.
Yeah, yeah.
And even from a distance, it was like, that was great. That was a really, really special moment. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I've been like cage side cornering at the UFC and stuff like that in the past, but that was just as special, frankly. You got a connection with someone, so yeah. That's what sport's all about, isn't it?
So we've talked a lot about like your coaching, and obviously what you're most known for is your business, strength and conditioning, education. How did you ran a lot of it in the background, but how did you kind of see that as being important? Because obviously you got a job at the university, English Institute of Sport, and most strength and conditioning coaches like move from jobs to jobs, institutions to universities and stuff like that. How did you transition to going like kind of on your own path?
Yeah, I mean, I always had something inside of me that wanted to be independent, and I'm not sure why that is, to be frank. I think that's deeper than just a business strategy. I think that is something from childhood. Maybe that's a different conversation altogether. Yeah, yeah. But I always had a sort of fire that was burning, leading me to think I should be able, I want to do this in a different way. And I think because I didn't have a sort of straightforward pathway into S&C, like I did it in a different way. I was a martial artist. I wanted to have a martial arts gym. I did a different degree. It didn't feel like the classic sort of sports science master's internship. You know, I felt like a different playbook was relevant. And then the biggest turning point that was a realization for me was when I was working for British Tennis and they changed their strategy, which, as is their right to do as a governing body, but basically it was essentially saying, Brendan, you need to move to the National Tennis Centre in London to work full time from there, or we're going to make you redundant. We're going to change that role. And there was two or three of us in the roles that they were saying this to.
Yeah, so you were at mercy to the...
Yeah, and I didn't want to move to London at the time. I had some interesting projects going on. I was doing some other rugby league work and so on. And it just made me think, I need to have control of my destiny ultimately. I need to be able to say, no, that's not that. I'm not going to be at the mercy of a governing body or a funder like a lot of coaches are. And that was a big, big turning point, because it was like, right, I need to make this work right now. And I had a couple of months to sort of sort myself out and start earning money. I think from there it was combining that turning point and that, if you like, that inner fire with a real deep passion and drive to further and better myself.
Yeah.
And at the same, so I'd been writing blogs. I built my own website back in the day that looked like a Word document online. It was absolutely terrible.
I can resonate with that.
Yeah, you're sure. But it did the job, because it's about the content. And so I think those two things dovetail to sort of say, actually, I've got something here. And it turned into a business based on a lot of people in the UK, say in the personal training space or just in general, wanting to know how to train athletes and how to train for performance instead of aesthetics. And I started doing workshops for my own development. It was all driven by my desire to improve myself as a coach.
Yeah.
But getting experts in the early days, like people like Jared Deakin and other just friends and colleagues.
Yeah, first time I came across you was when you did the Vern Gambetta.
Yeah. It was an awesome weekend, wasn't it?
Well, I only had it online. I remember, don't know how I downloaded it. I think I downloaded it and then had it on a memory stick. I remember getting back with a good friend of mine, Al Spate, and Tim Jarrett, who's up in Leeds strength and conditioning coach. I remember getting back and like sticking the memory stick in and being excited to go and watch Vern Galletta. Yeah. But I remember them like workshops with Dan Baker as well, Duncan French. Yeah. What was the process in getting that? And was there, we talked off camera a little bit about how the element of risk.
Yeah.
You know, was a bit of risk in there because you've got obviously got to guarantee them their pay to fly them over and everything like that and get people in a room.
Risk is huge in this whole thing of growing a business, in my opinion, and being okay with risk, but also understanding risk for yourself. That is a massive, massive area of how to grow a business. And you're totally right. Like, those early days, it was a risk. I put my hand in my pocket to fund those things with no guarantees that I wasn't going to end up. Yeah, those people are expensive, even back then, like 15 years ago. And, you know, flights, weekends of accommodation, and obviously their costs. And then you have to sell the courses and so on and so forth. So, yeah, like it, but it's, I think there are moments where you just have to think, you know what, it's got to be done.
Yeah.
Like, this work is important. Like, I really want to bring Vern Galletta over and Dan John and Dan Baker and some of those guys. And so it's too important sometimes, and you can kind of overcome the risk with, do you know what, it needs to happen. I believe in it, but hopefully 40 other people believe in it because they bloody need to make this thing work. But if it hadn't, you're still there thinking, well, yeah, but we still did a weekend with Vern Galletta that I think was the first in the country at the time in that way. So it's, you know, that's core values of, like, one of my core values is doing things first and and being bold.
Being first,
And so I do think when you look back at it, you think, well, actually, if that had bombed, if nobody had come, I still would have been able to nail that weekend and I'd have had Vern Galletta for 2 days to learn from. And so it's like you can sort of game it a little bit, I think. And when it comes to risk, that's part of what you've got to do, I think, these days.
What was your strategy to try and reduce that risk? Obviously, you had people in a room. How did you advertise it? And then also, like, how did you optimize it financially? Because we're saying about I weren't there at that Vern Galletta, but I purchased the videos and everything. Without going too specific with the numbers, how did you, you know, try and optimize that in the best way possible?
So I think going back a couple of steps, I had committed to content marketing. I didn't know it was called that at the time, but I'd committed to writing emails every week, blogging what I was doing with my athletes and my clients and stuff like that. And I'd published it on the website. So I'd write a blog and I'd send an email to people saying, I've written this blog, go and check it out. And that sounds so obvious, but no one was really doing it back then. And it took me a long time to build the habit to do 3 emails a week. And then I remember one of the turning points on the video side of things was Dan Howells, who is, I'm not sure where he's at now, but a really, really prominent S&C coach in his own right, been with England Rugby. He emailed me and he said, look, I'm in Twickenham, I'm in London. I can never get to your sessions. Why don't you film them?
Okay.
And make them available. And it's, when you look back now, that again, that's obvious, but ultimately that's serving your market, isn't it? That's that your customers have asked you for something.
Yeah.
Create it for them. That's entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. That's following the need of the market and saying, yep, we've done it for you. Here we go. Here's the video now. And to be honest, it went literally that one event that we filmed turned my business from what I would have termed at the time an events business to an online content, online video business overnight.
Yeah.
And it changed the strategy because now it didn't become as important to sell out the workshops.
Absolutely.
Because we had the following online that we could make that content available for download. And that was streamable and downloadable globally. We had we had Real Madrid coaches downloading stuff. We had coaches in America downloading. Yeah. It was brilliant.
Yeah.
But it totally changed the business. So the de-risking of that was done from building up the email list, building up the partnerships network.
Yeah, building the audience.
Building the audience. And I always say to people now, so like, the first thing you need to do, forget your products, is build your audience. Once you've built your audience, you can ask them what they want, what would help them, and go and build them what they've asked for. Yeah. And then improve on that and improve on it again and so on and so forth. So yeah, those workshops in the early days were de-risked through my content marketing and also good quality partnerships with, say, governing bodies that would buy two or three places for their coaches. And those two strategies remain really prominent in my business today. Yeah. And are great strategies for any business, full stop.
Yeah.
Build your audience and develop partnerships.
Yeah.
You know, it's not rocket science.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, like we're talking about this, about creating content and becoming like an online content company. We're talking 10, 12, 15 years ago where, yeah, you know, people weren't doing this. Like now, it is kind of, that's the go-to thing to do.
Yeah.
So you've gone from an events company online. When did it kind of transition to what it is today? Like, obviously you had your mentorship and then going to a qualification process as well.
Yeah, so
steps that you took with that.
Well, to be honest, again, it came from serving the market, to be honest, Danny, in that I didn't believe, and from speaking to people, that workshops were enough to facilitate a development of a coach, an S&C coach or any coach, and that there needed to be more in there, and it needed follow-up, it needed touch points, it needed mentoring, you know, that everybody knows it's pretty much proven that having good mentors will accelerate your career, accelerate your development. You're going to earn more money, you're going to get there faster, and this is, forget business, this is if you're an employee in an organization. So that started informally of, can you help me? You know, can I come up and see you at your gym in Leeds? Or can you help me to design some programs? Yeah, sure. Informal kind of daily. Yeah, come up and see me for a day or half a day. And then actually, let's do this bi-monthly.
Yeah.
And the first mentorship was 9 months, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. It was 9 months. I'd started that in sort of 2012, 13, 14. And then I went full time into the mentorship in 2015.
Yeah.
And that year, I think we had 250 people on that mentorship.
Wow.
In that first year.
That's unbelievable. Which,
yeah, I mean, it was too many, to be honest. There's a good lesson there to not take too many people on.
You can see the kind of people coming in, obviously the money coming in.
Yeah.
You can be like, right, this is, try and do as many as you can.
Yeah.
But
there's a natural desire there, but there is an unpicking of, like, we've got to be able to deliver on our promises. You know, I really do believe in make big, big promises and your promises should sort of keep you awake at night, but you've got to deliver on those promises. And you're never going to please everyone. I used to be really personally invested in, I still am, but anything that didn't go well, I really, really felt it personally. Yeah. But when you're trying to make a big impact, you're going to make some mistakes as well. There is going to be the odd person that doesn't feel like they got that, but all you can do is work as hard as you can to rectify it. Nobody's perfect and no company is perfect. Yeah. So that mentorship and that process of taking so many students basically took strength and conditioning education into an education company and a course provider, let's call it that.
Yeah.
But also it was the signal of, I can't do this on my own as well. Yeah. So early 2015, I had one employee and by the end of 2015, I had 15 full-time employees. And it was brutal. It was tough. And it was great. It was really, really involved. We were trying our hardest. But again, it was just massive, massive scale, massive growth. And, you know, it went from there, really.
Yeah. What are the key challenges when you are scaling up and employing people? Well, what were the first kind of levels of employment? Did you recruit? What were the most important kind of members of staff that you recruited, and what were the challenges for you when you were scaling up?
Yeah, it's really, really relevant points and questions. So I think, just backtracking a second, I think anybody listening to this, if you've got a business or if you want to have a business, I think one of the questions to ask yourself is, where do you want to take this business? What is the vision of this business? Because there's absolutely nothing wrong with being a one-man band or a two-man band. And that might work really well for you. Yeah. A bigger business and growing it into like a performance business and a company that you ultimately could sell or exit is something that is not for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I have this philosophy that I call it impact and income. And that I always say, the bigger the impact you make, the bigger the income. And you should be leading with impact. And so you can make a real dent if you drive forward to say, how do we make the biggest possible impact? And I did not look back and question that back in the day. I probably would now, for the reasons I said, you know, about like over being oversubscribed. But the process of hiring, I made every mistake. I think I've pretty much made everyone. Hopefully there's not too many more.
Yeah.
But I hired, if you like, friends or people that were probably not that well suited to the roles, but they were just there.
Yeah.
And I didn't really go through a process of saying, okay, I want to choose from four great people. You're just like, can you do the job? Yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
And I wanted to move fast, and speed is another core value of like getting things done quickly. So that seemed to fit. But actually, I think you've got to sometimes take things slower to move faster in the long run, because you just end up falling over, tripping over your own feet and leaving a trail of debris behind that somebody's got to go and clear that up.
Yeah.
And so the best things I ever did from a hiring perspective, and I really do subscribe to this right now, is understanding what you do really well, what you don't do really well, and genuinely bringing better people than you in to do those things that you don't do really well. And that's easier said than done, because those people are not cheap. They're actually expensive.
Yeah.
Getting good people costs money, especially if you want their commitment to grow your business for you and with you. So when I started to not penny pinch and pay legitimately high salaries and you know, enviable salaries to people, you get really good talent that actually is a part of your business then, that legitimately are better than you, are better than you at whatever they do. And that's when you can grow a company, for me. And I realized in 2015 that needed to happen, and headhunted directors and people from other companies that could come in, but they really weren't cheap. I cut deals with them, you know, initially started it with certain people as consultants and then scaled it so they were then full-time employees. But I think the vision has to come first of, what do you want here? Because if you don't really want a big business, which is fine, you don't need to go and headhunt top-class directors and individuals that can run that business. But I recognised back in 2015-16 that I wanted to build a business that was a market-leading, the biggest business in the country in what we did, and something that potentially I could sell and move on to other things in the future, which is something that we achieved back in 2019. And so, again, it's risk. It's risk. It's taking a leap, but a calculated risk, and ultimately de-risking it as much as you can. But you never, ever can eliminate risk. You can only de-risk it and mitigate it slightly.
Like what you're saying there about like kind of getting the best people on board, not penny pinching, because when you're a one-man band and then you start seeing like a decent income coming in, you've worked hard behind the scenes, you've done... When you compare like kind of the hours that you put in, the money that's actually gaining is like below minimum wage when you're first starting out. And then you start bringing in decent income, but then you're thinking, right, now we're actually wanting to grow it. Can you actually do that yourself? And then you, all the money that you've earned kind of thing, you think like it's yours. And then next minute you're having to give it to like people that you needed to employ, but you need to have that long-term vision.
Yeah.
In the future. And it all depends on how far you do want to take the business. You know, if I wanted Boxing Science to be just me training athletes in a gym, I'd I'd just say it's what I'm doing at the minute. But I'm wanting Boxing Science to grow and have franchises and stuff like that.
Exactly,
so
yeah.
I've got to try and employ people to make sure that we get into a position where we can be able to do that. So it's great hearing that, I think.
And just one more point. I think, yeah, you're doing a really amazing job with Boxing Science. And I think that it's ultimately down to where you want to take it.
Yeah.
But delaying gratification is a really relevant point, because when you're making a good income for yourself through a business, it is tempting. It's like, yeah, let's do it. Let's go get nice cars or buy the house or what have you. But if you have that vision clear, you know, the people that really get wealthy and really succeed, and it's not just about the money, but they make that massive impact. They've delayed that gratification and they've pushed it down the road a little bit and reinvested it in that way. And I mean, there's the old marshmallow study, isn't there? The children, they did this study on children and they said, I think they were 5-year-olds or 4-year-olds, and they basically gave them a marshmallow and they said, here it is on a table in front of you, but if you wait for 2 minutes and not eat that marshmallow, we'll give you a second marshmallow. And they tracked that over a longitudinal period. And the kids that turned down the first marshmallow and they waited for the second one achieved significantly more in business because of that trait of ultimately delaying gratification.
Yeah.
So that's the game, mate. If you can turn a marshmallow down, you'll probably do all right.
That's it. I'm going to have to try that out when I get home.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm not sure I could do that now.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Level 4 strength and conditioning qualification. Obviously, you've come from a different background to most S&C coaches, but then you're in an institute in university, and the traditional route is to go university and then UKCA.
Yeah.
Did you feel that there was a need for that Level 4 S&C qualification, and what kind of separated that from the more traditional route that people were taking at that time?
Yeah, I did. I did feel there was a big need for it because, and I still do today, I don't believe that the conventional education routes deliver. You know, the sets and reps is just one pillar. So we have this thing, we call it the 3 pillars approach. And it's the technical development, the personal development, and then the career development. And under career is business. And most pathways really tackle the technical development.
Yeah.
They give you tons and tons of knowledge. It may be good knowledge, it may be relevant knowledge, but they give you lots of knowledge. And actually, what coaches need and people need, frankly, is the personal and the career development. They need to know, where are you going to take this? Why are you doing it? That's the personal pillar. And then they need that career and business strategy of, so how are you going to coach people then? How are you going to get clients? How are you going to get a job? How are you going to grow your career over 5 years and 15 years and beyond? And that's what I felt was lacking. And I think what we've done really well is marry those 3 pillars. The technical knowledge is good, but actually it's more about, where are you going to take this then? How are you going to create that? It's the impact and income again. It's like, so you might want to get paid as an S&C coach or a trainer, but how are you going to attract clients to you? How are you going to get that transaction to take place? You've got to be able to deliver a good product, but you've also got to be able to get the clients in. And the irony of it is if you don't have any clients, how can you tell me you're a great coach?
Yeah.
You know, most people in our space, I'm sure it's the same for you, definitely was for me, was kind of led by, initially in the early stage of my career, I wanted to be a world-class S&C coach. I really wanted to push myself to do that. Mm-hmm. That's where SCE was born. But when you look at it, you think, well, if I didn't have any clients or I couldn't get a job, like, how could I be a world-class S&C coach then?
Yeah.
So if you don't address the business side of attracting clients, serving clients, and growing that business, you can't, let alone earn any money, you can't be a great coach either. And they really work intertwined in that way. So that's why the Level 4 succeeds, because we deliver that for people. Mm. And the mentoring element of that is woven in all the way through. There's always touch points. There's a network that you can be a part of. So that's where we, you know, nothing makes me smile more than having somebody go through the course, but then in 6 months' time, they're fully booked, or, you know, they're training athletes in the Olympics or what have you. It's awesome. But you kind of think that's not because you know how to write a great program. It's because you've figured out how to connect with the people that need that program and bring them into your ecosystem. So I think to your point, and the question is, what is the Level 4 all about, and how does that work? I think that was what drove me to build that and drive it. And I think, you know, it works really well. We have 2,500 graduates every year go and through that course. Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And I'm really proud of that, because there is a need for that in the marketplace.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be on the course otherwise. So, yeah, I'm pleased with what we've managed to contribute there.
But I think that it's really important, because people are accessing strength and conditioning in a totally different way than what they were 15 years ago.
Yeah.
The strength and conditioning role, like, still I say strength and conditioning to people, and the people are just like, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
But definitely 10, 15 years ago, people didn't understand it. But then now, more and more people are either wanting to be a strength and conditioning coach or wanting to strength and conditioning training. It has become more and more popular. But that means that there's a lot of kind of dogma about, there's a lot of stuff on Instagram, and people don't know which way to look and everything.
Yeah.
I think that it's a better way in educating people and making sure that the standards of strength and conditioning is higher, because if they didn't have that, then what have they got in terms of the education stuff?
And you know this better than anyone, in that you've got to understand the principles deeply and not be led by preferences.
Yeah.
And if you see a lot of stuff on social media or whichever area that you get your content from, and a lot of it is preference led. It's like, I love doing kettlebells, or I love doing weightlifting, Olympic weightlifting, or CrossFit, or whatever. All of those are fine, but is it principle based? And do you, as the coach, aspiring coach, do you have the knowledge and the confidence to unpick that and say, where does that fit in to this athlete or group's program? And that's really what we teach. It's the ability to break down those preferences or those individual tools to understand where they fit. That's what good coaching is. And obviously then communicating that to your market, to your audience.
Yeah, I think another good thing is that, like, I'm guessing it's because how you got into strength and conditioning as well, like changing your career path. You were in construction and then decided to go in and then had to convince the university and go on trial periods and stuff like that. Mm. There's a lot of people, especially on our courses, that are going through a career change.
Yeah.
And I asked a question, should I go to university? And this guy was in his mid-30s, got a couple of kids.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I don't think you should, because it's taking, what are you wanting to achieve? Oh, I'm wanting to be a freelance personal trainer, strength and conditioning coach, and I'm wanting more clients and everything. I'm like, well, that is a long thing to do. It's a very expensive thing to do as well.
Yeah.
I think what you're doing is giving people an option to away from university.
Yeah.
But and even people that do go to university, they don't have the handhelds. They show them, like, they get given a couple lectures during the week. They get an assignment to do, and then once they get the qualification, it's like all the best.
I know.
The degree is like all the best in the future, and there still is a lot of development from being 21 years old when I graduated. I was fortunate to carry on with my masters, and I had good mentors around me and good internships. But not many people have that, especially if they're in a remote location. I was in Sheffield. There was loads of different opportunities at Sheffield United Football Club, Sheffield Eagles, working with Nick Ward and everything.
Yeah.
So
I
had lots of different mentors knocking about.
Yeah.
But if you got going, I don't know, that somewhere in the countryside or something like that, it's hard to continue that development.
Yeah,
I think that the mentorship and the qualification is definitely needed.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And like I sort of have a similar opinion to yourself on the university side of things. I think if it's an itch that you must scratch, like if you just deeply feel like you want to get a degree, then sure. Like, who am I to say that's the wrong move? But we've got to get out of this entitlement mentality of, because that's what happened with the whole degree thing and some of the courses that are existing, in that it's like, right, I'll get my degree, I'll get my master's, I'll get my accreditation, and then, right, where's the job?
Yeah.
And it doesn't make you a good coach, and it definitely doesn't get you a job.
Yeah.
And yet people challenge the model of, well, yeah, but if you're an amazing coach that delivers transformational results, who cares what your qualifications yeah. are? But now I think that model has been proven.
Yeah.
In that, if you look at there's so many coaches there now across the country and across the world that they haven't got degrees, they haven't got the pieces of paper that everybody else has got, but yet they're rolling out elite athletes, they work with them all the time, they deliver for them. Combat sports have actually given a good platform to that, because combat sports does like a maverick model and an orthodox model. And there's amazing trainers worldwide that haven't gone down that traditional path, but yet they know how to get results in the trenches. So I do think that we're in a slightly different place now, but I think the key point here is pieces of paper, degrees, whatever, they do not get you a job. Being a great coach in the trenches and committing to something for 5 years, 10 years and more, that's what turns you into an elite coach. I'm sure you'd agree, because you've done that with boxing science.
Yeah, well, half joking here with the boxers, it's like, you've never asked me whether I'm qualified. You haven't asked what qualifications I have and stuff like that. And it's like, when you're working with coaches, when you're working with athletes on a one-to-one basis, you go in and you have a conversation about what we can do for them, what the package is and everything like that, and how we can enhance their performance as an athlete. I never like go in with my CV or list of qualifications and stuff like that. And I think there is an issue with that in boxing at the moment, because there isn't a standard that boxers can recognize as basically the friends or somebody that's in the gym. And then that's when you get like some, like I say, a bit of dogma, a bit of BS training. Yeah. So there does need to be a standardization. And I think that's what boxing science are looking at and trying to standardize everything. But at the same time, it takes you away from that degree element and actually needing that, because nobody's ever asked me like for my CV or my credentials or anything. I could be bullshitting them all this time.
But you wouldn't get the results you got if you were bullshitting them, could you? And that's the key point. And it never stops. Yeah. You're always learning on the job.
Yeah.
Which is another issue that you see, is that it creates a mentality, if you're not careful, of like, right, I'm done now. I've got my badges. You know, come on, let's go.
Yeah.
But it never stops. You're always backfilling. Every time you take a new step and a new level, like in my case, I've done tons of stuff like financial education to try and improve my knowledge of all of those areas. It never stops.
If you've
got growth aspirations for yourself or your business or your clients and athletes, the learning never, ever stops. And it's just a continual commitment to improvement, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Just going back to what you're saying about developing them business-wise to make sure that they're getting clients, I think that's really important matter for people to develop, because people's mindsets when they first get into strength and conditioning is, I can do this for a low wage, I can do this, I can do those hours for free, I can do weekends, I can do evenings, and that's when you're young and you don't have demands and responsibilities. But then when you get a little bit older and then you start getting a mortgage, you get a partner, you look at potentially having kids and stuff, and you think like, one, I need a better income, and two, I need a bit of more spare time as well. And I think it's important. I always like reiterate it to young coaches that come in here that I mentor, is that's the mindset that you'll have in 5, 6, maybe 10 years time, where you might want to transition. You don't want to be like spending all the evenings and weekends coaching. So you need to kind of future-proof yourself the business. And I've seen a lot of coaches that are in full-time jobs that think, right, I need to a little bit more free time, but it just doesn't happen like that. So I think that's an important aspect to include into the education format. But something that kind of segue into like your career, obviously you've gone from a strength and conditioning coach to building strength and conditioning education. Now you're the chairman and doing, is it Impact?
Yeah, Impact Learning.
Can you resonate with that in terms of like going away from like the gym floor and changing responsibilities and kind of your career direction as well?
Yeah, definitely. I found it, there's a big identity shift with that. Yeah. And I think like I used to coach, hands-on coach in the gym 60 hours a week.
Yeah.
And you don't deliver world-class coaching sessions when you're just rattling them out one after the other, after the other, after the other. You might get develop an eye for coaching, which is important, but actually the thought and reflection is not there. So I do think there's a sweet spot, even when you're an up-and-coming coach, to not actually coach too much because you don't have chance to deliver your best.
Yeah.
And then for me, in the early stages, I really had that identity confusion of I'm an S&C coach.
Yeah.
And if I come out of the gym, hang on, what is that then? I'm not, what am I now? And it took me quite a while to reconcile that as, no, I'm a coach and I can use S&C, but actually coaching is really at my core. And I can coach my employees, I can coach myself, I can work with partners. And again, it comes back to that vision of like, well, hang on a minute. I'm training these athletes to achieve their personal best, Olympics and so on and so forth, whatever.
Yeah.
But what about me? How do I achieve my person? What is that? How far can I take this thing? And I come back to the whole impact and income, that the bigger I push, the bigger I drive, the more impact that I can make, and the more coaches I can help, and the more ultimately the end users benefit. So that's what really drove me and still does to this day. And so going back to the whole backfilling education and acquiring new skills, it's never really a consideration for me about should I or shouldn't I. It's just like, just get it done, because this is going to make me better. And even if I learn how not to do it, or if somebody else is going to do this job for me, I need to be able to ask them the right questions and understand that we've got the right person in the seat here. So yeah, it was a gradual evolution, but absolutely was led by how far can I take this thing and really what can I do here? And that's sort of where I sit today is, you know, I've got a big vision for Impact Learning, and SCE is one part of that vision, really. It's an important part, but I don't think it'll ever stop. I think it'll certainly not for the next 10, 20 years, I hope, anyway.
Yeah. Before we go on to like kind of future plans and probably rounding off this podcast, what we've talked about a lot about your journey so far, how do you kind of reflect on it, and what do you think is the most proudest kind of part of what you've achieved so far?
It's a great question, mate. It's a tough question. I'm really proud of SCE and the contribution it makes.
Yeah.
You know, that's great. Personally, I'm proud of building a company that works for itself or is under management in that way. And I've achieved a level, not a lot, but a level of life balance that works for me and my family, and I can contribute in multiple areas. Yeah. I don't really take pride in just grinding all day every day. I think balance is really important. And you know, as an S&C coach, there was lots and lots of moments there that athletes winning or competing and achieving things that they didn't think they could. Amazing. And actually now I kind of look at that and I think I really want other people to achieve that with their athletes, with their clients. But so some of the prouder moments are things like when you see an athlete that you worked with when they were, say, 14, 15? Like, there's a badminton player that I trained. She was in the England GB squad for the 2012 games.
Okay.
Now, she'll probably be knocking on 30 now. And I saw her in the gym a few years ago, having not trained her for quite a while. And she was front squatting absolutely perfectly. Yeah. She was moving really well. And I was like, that's... And I said to her, it's really good to see you continuing with these habits, because it's not just about sport and medals. It's actually about health and longevity. And you see someone like that and you think, yeah, those movement mechanics probably never leave her forever. Yeah. And there's a few examples of people like that that you think, it's strength and conditioning has been a vehicle to turn them into a well-rounded adult and human.
Yeah.
And that's really cool, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
That's why we do this thing, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's, yeah, some good moments.
Good stuff. And what does the future hold next 5-10 years? What are your future goals and visions?
Yeah, lots of stuff, mate. And I really enjoy still mentoring and working with coaches.
Yeah.
I really enjoy it from an involved perspective of being in their companies. So I love working with company owners, business owners that want to scale, maybe even sell and exit their business. And that's really why I set up Impact Learning Group. I want to grow that business. And it's not just in health and fitness, it's not just in the S&C space. That's all different kind of vocational education verticals, if you like. So I'm excited about that. And excited to continue the growth of SEE as well. I think we've got some good plans there. We've got a really good management team in there as well. And I think I'll probably do some S&C coaching soon, but it might be my own kids that are getting into basic movement patterns soon, Danny. So
the training plan starts now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, Brendan, I won't take any more of your time. It's been fantastic to talk to you about your journey. I'm sure that a lot of our listeners will be taking a lot of nuggets of information there and applying it to not only the coaching but to the business as well. So thanks very much for coming on the Boxing Science Podcast.
Yeah, really, really appreciate you having me, mate. It's been great to chat.
Cheers.